This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's fan club on FUBAR Radio.
That is the closest we've ever come to not going on air. I don't know if you heard that. No, of course you haven't. We've just come on air. But it was all kicking off in the fan club clubhouse. I've got bacon in my mouth. basically, we are continue our quest to get the very best guests for you to listen to on air for our listeners to hear. And we've got some absolute bangers coming up in the following weeks. But it was kicking off in here because we were really pushing the envelope. Now,
talking about pushing the envelope, I've got an envelope.
God, envelope. Me and Nat were literally talking till 3 seconds to midday.
Yeah.
And nearly didn't press the button, but we did, and as we pressed it, and we went on air as we do every week. Natalie gave me a withering look, as if to say, "Well, you got away with it this time, Helm."
But never not been on time.
Never not been on time. Never not been live, except for the series of pre-records. Not pre-recording this week, though.
Even
though
live.
It was an option, but we've gone for it. We've really got. It's been basically.
Nick has been filming, but he's taking his day off.
I'm filming the second series of Reluctant Landlord, Ramesh Ranganathan's TV. Yeah, I guess it's a sitcom, and we thought that we weren't going to do it live this week, and we'd have to pre-record it sometime. No, we thought it was going to be a greatest hits for most of the week, didn't we?
I think we did, and then suddenly
had a guest lined up for today, and then we're going to bump them to Monday and pre-record on Monday, and then
they couldn't do that. And then we realised we could do today,
and then we did that today, and then we phoned him up and said, "Are you busy?" And he said, "I'm not busy anymore. I've arranged a big lunch." And we were just like, "Oh, is it an important lunch?" He said, "No, it's just me at home, but I've bought a loaf of bread for it and plenty of cheese, and I've ordered a Breville maker from Amazon, and I actually have to be in Friday morning because that's when they said they're going to deliver it between the hours of 8 a.m. and 1 p.m.
which would cover the time of our show,
which would cover like the beginning of the time of the show. I said, but you know, if it arrives at 1 p.m. then don't you think that you could probably just about you could run and make it, you know, from one side of London to the other? And he said,
yeah, but it's a bit early for a lunch.
He said it's a bit early for lunch and I'm not actually going to be able to do it. I said, but well, can you bump the lunch to after 2 p.m. and he said, do you know what, I'm just going to bloody go and cancel that Breville. And he did as well. And
we'll find out who that was
and we
later
found,
on.
He told me later, do you know what he did with that bread?
What's that?
He went along and fed the ducks.
Oh, what a lovely guy.
Well, it's actually very bad for the ducks. So
is it?
A bit of a cunt. Anyway, he'll be on later. Or she. It's a he. Of course it's a he.
That's fan club.
That's fan club. they're the only people available. White men. you laugh, but it's true. I mean, we're trying to do our bit for diversity, but
the dance group.
The dance group. We should get them
diversity.
On. We should get them on. Actually, I suppose they'd be the worst guests to have on, wouldn't they?
They could be doing a dance. We'd be enjoying it.
No one would be able to. They might hear the occasional, you know, shuffle or
body pop
or wobble as someone bumped into a piece of equipment in this very cramped environment.
It's very cramped for dance.
It'd be terrible for a dance troupe. Especially
I can't do like a backflip, but they'd probably hit the head on that. It's got a hard surface.
It's got to be so many corners, so many hard surfaces. So you don't really want to. Anyway, I'm Nick Helm,
and I'm Nathaniel Metcalf,
and you're listening to Nick and Nats Nathaniel Metcalf's fan club. Always do your surname, Nat.
Should do. So, that's what you should do in stand up, isn't it? You should always say your name at the end, so people remember you.
I say it at the beginning as well. Hi, I'm Nick Helm,
and you should tell people to follow you on Twitter, shouldn't they? And give them your Twitter handle so people can write it down
and also
while they're watching the gig.
Keep supporting live comedy and follow me on Twitter and Insta, which I believe is short for Instagram. I just feel like this is a really odd episode already.
I'm enjoying it.
I'm talking in an unusual voice, one that isn't my own. If it's the first time you've listened to Fan Club, we do insist that you take your trousers and pants off. it's just for the first time you listen to it. Everyone that's listened to it has done it so far. So if it's the first time you listen to Fan Club,
not every week, doesn't matter. Just this week.
It's just for first timers. So if you're in an office or on a bus, or if you listen back to it on iTunes, you know, maybe someone's told you about it. Because the first rule of Fan Club is tell your friends about Fan Club. Second rule of Fan Club, please, for the love of God, tell your friends about Fan Club. Okay. Third rule of Fan Club is tell your friends about Fan Club. Interestingly, all of the rules for Fan Club are tell your friends about Fan Club. Mm-hmm. But when you get up to, something funny happens when you get up to rule 57. And that is, if it's the first time you've listened to Fan Club, and you listen to it now, you do have to remove your trousers and pants. Socks can stay on.
If you want, optional. It's up to you. I don't mind, really, if they do or don't.
I don't mind if of course, when I take my pants off, my socks come off anyway, because I use them to stuff my pants. socks can come off. But and don't write in complaining. I don't make the rules. No. I do. So if you're on a bus or if you're operating heavy machinery, you shouldn't actually be listening to the show if you are operating heavy machinery. Not because it sends you to sleep, but because some of our opinions are so damn anarchic, you know, that you might spasm and use a crane as some sort of wrecking ball.
Mm.
For instance, I think Monsters, Inc. is average. Oh, have we got an explosion sound effects? We've got a... No. That'll do.
Gunshot with cock.
What's your most controversial opinion, Matt? I don't know why I'm talking like this. This isn't
my most controversial opinion.
What's your most... hang on.
Nick and Matt's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
What you're actually thinking, Matt, never say it.
Don't say it, okay.
I messed up there. I shouldn't have... for the people that have just tuned in... Nathaniel has a very dark private life. Some of his opinions are not worth... Let me just rephrase the question before you answer it. What is your most controversial opinion about films?
Oh, I'm sure I do have some.
Thank God I've rephrased that.
I remember once watching...
Let's just say Nat's still pushing for a hard Brexit.
I once saw Des and Mel, Des O'Connor. Sorry about that. Nick's trying to have his headphones posted.
What I did was I whispered, I'm a little bit quiet, right
into the microphone.
It's the microphone. But it's unusual for me not to pay attention to you while you're talking, isn't it? Oh, I love it. Oh, it's been so... Oh, it's filming, it's awful. So go on.
I was going to say... So an episode of Des and Mel once where the guest was...
I'm just going to eat some bacon and listen.
I can see you. The guest was Jim Davidson, and they said...
wow.
And they said, Jim, and it's a really light-hearted show, Des and Mel. Audience full of pensioners. And they say, Jim, here's a funny thing. What do you think of the current government? And he was like, oh, they're a shambles, aren't they? And he's like, yeah. And everyone laughed. And he said, what would you do if you were Prime Minister? And you think, don't ask Jim Davidson.
Come on, Des.
And then he said, then immediately Jim Davidson went and goes, well, probably give a bit more money to the pensioners, stand innovation, of course. And you think, well, you're absolutely playing to the crowd there. And he goes, and then I pull up the drawbridge. And he was just, and also then got another stand innovation. Nick needs some tissues, I think.
I was drinking herbal tea when you... oh, God. Oh, fucking hell. Was it live?
Must have been, I think. They certainly didn't cut it out.
There's a man. Oh, my God.
What would you do if you're Prime Minister for the day? It's like, not actually a serious question.
They should do one of them Channel 5 clip shows, shouldn't they?
Yeah.
Retrospectively, worst questions to ask people on live TV. Something like that. 50 retrospectively, most awful moments of live TV. Jim Davidson, what would you do if you were Prime Minister?
Well, you think like, you know, you think it's going to be a light-hearted answer.
And it did start off quite...
Started like, quite light-hearted, or certainly quite positive.
Double standing A's, fucking hell.
But it does make you go, yep, I mean, that's the old pit of it again. Just gone, yep, we agree with that one as well. Fully on board.
Well, maybe...
If he ran for Prime Minister, he'd probably get in.
He probably would get in.
He probably would, yeah.
He probably would get in. I'm not saying that... I know that there's loads wrong with Jim Davidson in terms of politically and what you mean, like current climate and all that. Well, not just current climate, the climate for the last
40 years.
But it must be 30 years. But he must have been kind of like during the '80s, quite a controversial character then as well.
Yeah.
But I haven't really ever seen him do. I've seen him do stand up on BBC when they gave him his Billy Connolly style series.
Yes. Yeah.
But that's obviously TV. I've never seen one of his sort of like videos.
No, I haven't.
When they're, you know, like that were all like 18 certificate. And also, just talking about like comedy in general, when your act fails to live, do you know what I mean? When society has moved on from your act, and I'm not talking from personal experience, but when society has moved on from your act, it's kind of like, what are you meant to do? It's kind of like a crazy thing. But I don't know. I know Bernard Manning was the worst of the worst in terms of racism. I don't know. I know that Jim Davidson is incredibly sexist.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I haven't really watched his acts.
I don't know enough about Jim Davidson to just have that knee-jerk reaction that, oh, he's a racist.
Mm.
Bob Monkhouse, who is one of the greatest comedians that has ever lived, one of the greatest comedy minds of British comedy, Bob Monkhouse. And, you know, you judge some of his jokes by today's standards. And
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's just, I don't know. It's not being an apologist for it, but it is also just kind of like everything needs a context. But with Jim Davidson, I don't know anything about Jim Davidson because I've always just steered clear of him. In the pub, down the street. And sometimes I'll see him at the bus stop and I'll think, I'll wait for the next one. It was weird because when we were growing up, a lot of my friends' dads, and I didn't have many friends, so my friend's dad... had Jethro DVDs, Roy Chubby. I know, and Jethro isn't a racist. He's just an incomprehensible Cornishman. What you're on your phone now?
Well, I've got a message from our guest that I was going to show Natalie.
Oh right.
But
he's cancelled.
No.
Oh no. No, what? It's just dead air. It's just like me. Just talk out loud.
Call him from your phone and I'll speak to him.
Okay.
Siri, call our guest. Can you not do this? It must be. This is
like.
This is like.
I'm doing it.
I'm doing it for an explosion. It's number. And number 8. And 9. 9 is no clapping. Oh, we've got loads. You got that.
You covered that very well. No, I think we got away with that. Slick, isn't it?
They used to have like Roy Chubby Brown, Jim Davidson. I don't think Bernard Manning was even back then was
on telly. In my day, he's never really been on telly.
Bernard Manning was out by that point. I mean, he was.
I think as soon as the wave of alternative comedy hit. Bernard Manning was immediately out. Jim Davidson.
That's what it is, actually, isn't it? It's that their dads, my friend's dads, hadn't got into alternative comedy.
Yeah.
I was brought up in London, And so my mum was very much into sort of like French and Saunders and Victoria Wood and Jasper Carrot, and my dad was into Billy Connolly, who was like alternative, even when back when it was all club comedians. And yeah, so I guess what happened was they didn't broadcast Victoria Wood in the sticks. And if you wanted comedy, you'd have to
Well, I guess mainstream regular comedy would be like
Cinderella.
Yeah, Cinderella.
Jim Davidson's Boobs in the Wood.
they were his pantomimes, weren't they? His rude pantomimes.
Twat in Boots.
I once saw Jim Davidson. It makes it look like I watch lots of interviews with Jim Davidson, which I probably
anus,
would do.
Anus in. That's Aladdin. That's when he did Aladdin. Anal in. Jim Davidson's Bugger Boys.
And what was that based on?
That was based on Noddy. it wasn't Panto.
Right.
One of the selling points for Cinderella was sexist, naughty, and totally outrageous. That's weird. Although that's a quote from The Sun. A quote from The Sun saying, oh, you should watch Cinderella. It's sexist. Fucking hell.
Cinderella, spelt S-I-N.
Oh, I tell you what, though, Nat. You like racist comedy. You bloody love Bernard Manning. You should YouTube him. You should YouTube him. No, because you like racist stuff. It's not for me. I had a friend once that told me a joke. We were sat in his car, and he was like a friend of a friend, and he basically was holding me to ransom. It was the year that my best friend had gone to university. He'd taken a year out and he'd gone to university. So I was stuck in St. Albans. And the only two of us were in St. Albans. We were stuck in St. Albans together. And we were the only two that weren't at university at that point. I'd graduated and he'd stayed. We used to go to the gym together. And he just made it just so uncomfortably competitive. Yeah, boobs in the wood. He told me a joke, and I didn't laugh, and he went, oh, yeah, I forgot, you're not a racist. Like, it was
A bit of a weirdo.
Yeah, fucking hell.
But then in his head, he's acknowledged. What's interesting about that is I think people who are racist have that thing where they don't ever think, I am racist. I'm not racist.
I'm a monster.
Yeah,
but that's
sorry, I forgot you weren't racist.
But yes, yeah. Anyway, but you are racist. So, maybe anyone out there that's a big fan of racist or sexist comedy, send in your suggestions for Nat, and he'll be delighted. So, no, he's not a racist. Just a
Jim Davidson was going to.
I waggled my biro in between my mug and handle of the mug.
Yeah, create a little bell.
Just for my own amusement. It wasn't for anything. I forgot that we were on a very sound sensitive medium.
Jason was doing like he was going to do a not an adult pantomime. He was trying to do a big budget. All ages pantomime in the 90s, and I remember seeing an interview, and I think it was like
getting his generation game audience.
Yeah, so but actually doing it like I've done the adult ones, but I'm actually going to try and do a proper big budget pantomime that he's going to try and stage at like somewhere like the Palladium, I think it was. And it's the one that I can't remember it was like what one's got King Rat in it, what pantomime is that? Dick Whittington,
I think.
So I think it was going to be Dick Whittington, and he was going to do like an all ages pantomime, and he was saying. There he goes, yeah, basically, I've got Giga to design it. And he go, what? From Alien, the designer of...
HR Giga.
HR Giga was coming on board, working with Jim Davidson. And me and a friend of mine have been Googling this for years and found no evidence of it. But he was saying that was his plan. He was going to get... It was all going to be designed by HR Giga. And it was Jim Davidson's... All ages pantomime designed by H.R. Giger.
What, of Dick Whittington and his cat? Designed by H.R. Giger. What would be the benefit of that? That's mental. Although there was that film with John Malkovich and Jim Davidson.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I just think that I hear a lot of bad stuff about Jim Davidson, but I haven't necessarily seen from my own eyes the evidence. But yeah, I just know that you're not allowed to like him, and I don't know. But I don't really want to talk about Jim Davidson because...
how do we get on to Jim Davidson?
I don't know. It's just a boring subject, isn't it? It's just, who gives a fuck about Jim Davidson?
There's a picture of Jim Davidson.
Stop putting pictures of Jim Davidson up for us, all right? I don't give a fuck about Jim Davidson. So what have you been a fan of this week, Nat?
Not necessarily a fan. We don't usually go negative on Fan Club, but I have watched... yesterday, I watched the film... Nick lent me. I say lent because he's going to get it back.
I think you can have it.
No, it's fine.
All right.
I'll give it back. Nick lent me the DVD of a film called Master of Disguise with Dana Carvey. Brent Spiner, who you might know better as Data.
Data.
On Star Trek The Next Generation.
Make it so, Data. Data, come. Come, Data, come, make it so. Warp speed, Lieutenant Worf. Come, Data. Data.
I've been watching.
I'm so lonely in the confines of space. If only I had some companionship, Data. Come, make it so. I'm spread eagle for you, Data. Make it so.
Was this an episode?
No. I'm eating bacon wandering.
You are.
I'm eating a packet of Tesco's.
Tesco's?
Bacon strip. Tesco's bacon strip. And imagining some penetration of Deep Space Nine proportions. Anyway.
There's a bit on the commentary for it.
I'm just going to eat bacon and listen to you talk about Master of Disguise.
Yeah, fair enough. Master of Disguise is... Dana Carvey plays a character called Pistachio Disguisio.
Well, for a bit of context... Did we talk about this a couple of weeks ago?
No.
You came out for dinner, right? Mm. It was... So Mike Myers had done Austin Powers by... Yeah. What was that, 96, was it? Or 97?
99, I think. It was 96.
No, 99 was the second one.
You're right. And this is 2002 came out, but they're obviously... Someone's gone, hey, you know... Well, the Austin Powers films are the biggest films out at the minute. And you know, only one of the guys... That's only one of the guys from Wayne's World.
I don't think it was someone. I think it was Dana Carvey... said, I want some of the limelight that Mike Myers is having, so yeah. I'm going to do my own version of Austin Powers.
Yeah.
And it's going to be called Master of Disguise.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be about an international man of mystery. It's going to be about an international man of disguise.
And he's going to be Italian. He can't really do, for no reason really. I don't know why they've chosen for him to be Italian.
He can't do an Italian accent.
No, because he can't do the accent.
And it's an annoying voice that he puts on for the entire film.
Oh yeah, so he's never not doing this kind of ridiculous Italian accent, which is like a sort of...
He goes, "Oh papa,
yeah,
oh papa, I'm a master of disguise. Oh, my name is Pistachio Disguise. Oh, hi papa." And he does that for
the entire film.
For the entire film, an hour and a half.
Except, of course, when he is in disguise.
And this is 2002, and it was kind of like a kid's film. So who are some of the disguises that he puts on?
An Indian man.
Does an Indian man in a turban.
He does Quint from Jaws, because it's obviously like... He's gone through all the impressions that he thinks he can do and made like a sort of set piece involving that. One of them is also Al Pacino, but he's never... said is Al Pacino.
It's not just Al Pacino, though. It's Al Pacino
in Scarface.
And it's like Scarface was made 22 years ago. I think... Right, I'm saying this as the world's biggest Dana Carvey fan. I think he's shit.
It's sort of extraordinary. And it makes it... When I was watching it, I was going, I mean, was he... Has he ever been good? Because it's like a showcase for someone... It was not very good.
It's very much Dana Carvey's Split.
Yes, it is.
Where he's done a show reel of all of the things that he's good at.
George W. Bush.
And it's just like, his George W. Bush is awful,
very good.
But he was famous for doing George W. Yeah. Bush on Saturday Night yeah. Live. Well, I think he was famous for doing George Bush Sr. But basically, I really liked Dana Carvey. But it's amazing how much goodwill the character of Garth creates.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
then you will, I mean, he's made a lot of bad films. Like, he was in Wise Guys, he was in Clean Slate. He yeah. had like a whole career before Wayne's World came along. And then Master of Disguise is kind of like, it's absolutely spectacular. It's spectacular.
But it's not, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone as like, watch that, it's really bad. It's also an hour and 15 minutes. the end credits is 10 minutes long. So the film is like an hour, 5 minutes.
How is the end credits 10 minutes
because
long?
It goes through bit by bit as a sort of, it has like a reprise of all the characters again.
Oh, God.
So he does them as sort of like, has a little moment with each of the characters you've seen, which, were it a good film, it'd be like, oh, brilliant, we get to see these characters again, have another extra bit. Then it ends, and you know, in the film he has a robot that he fights who slaps him at the start, and that is controlled by a little man in the suit. And the film ends him freeing this guy who's a dwarf, who he then just starts running after, and this dwarf keeps slapping him, and it ends with him running after a dwarf, and then it says Paramount Pictures. That's after the credits. It's post-credit sequence. And then you watch it, and the DVD has deleted scenes, and when you watch the deleted scenes, you can't work out why. Like, it's not really clear why they've even been cut, because it's like, well, it's not. They're certainly as funny as anything else that's in the film. I don't know why they've cut this. There's a scene in which it's revealed that the dog is the granddad. So he's got a little dog sidekick.
So the granddad is played by who?
Oh, I don't know his name.
It's not like an established, dignified actor. I thought I thought it was Dr. Zhivago. What's his name?
Omar Sharif.
I thought it was Omar Sharif, but, no. But in retrospect, it's not. But the dad is played by the dad playing an Italian.
Yes.
An Italian. So it's like a generational. It's a generational what?
They're kind of like James Bond, aren't they?
But it's like a curse, or it's like a gift that's passed down through a family bloodline that you can do a disguise.
It's a magic thing, because they also get to. They've got. There's a magical element to it. Where they're able to.
Who's the woman in it?
It's what's her name? Was she called Jennifer Esposito?
Right.
She was in a bunch of films around the time,
and she's so very attractive in this film, and she's got to spend the entire film being in love with Dana Carvey, dressed up in a turban and brown face, and it's just like. Oh, it's mortifying. The whole film.
The film is
mortifying. Brent Spiner has got a running joke, doesn't he?
He farts. He farts occasionally.
He's the main bad guy.
The main bad guy
and
farts
at the end of all of his speeches, he farts and then runs out the room
It sounds. I think the way you talk about it is. I was thinking you can't talk about this without it making it sound like the kind of thing you go, oh, I'd like to see that, but you wouldn't.
It's awful.
You just
all
wouldn't
you
like
to
watch
do,
it.
All you need to do is watch the trailer. I think if you Master of Disguise is such a.
He dresses at one point as a turtle man.
A turtle man, which basically consists of a big green suit with a large collar.
Yeah.
So whenever he gets scared,
his head goes in there.
He ducks his head into his collar. Yeah. And his head.
That's
is like this bald, bulbous. I guess it's meant to be. He's meant to be a turtle. He's got these big glasses on, and he's got kind of like turtle lips.
And he's only dressed as a turtle because they go into a place called the Turtle Club.
And he thinks that you've got to dress up as a turtle.
Turtle to get in,
For no reason. So, my two favourite things about Master of Disguise is that. The first thing is, I was doing Comic Relief. No, I wasn't. I was doing Children in Need one year. doing a radio show for Children in Need. And I was in a green room. And Peter Serafinovitz was also on the bill. And I'd never met him before. And I don't think I met him on the night, actually. Maybe I shook hands with him. But we were all in this green room, and there was about 20 comedians. And Peter Serafinovitz had obviously just seen this film. And he went around one by one, every single comedian. You could hear him in the background as he went around all the comedians in the room. And he says, hi, I'm Peter. Have you ever seen a film called Master of Disguise? It stars a man called Dana Carvu. And then he'd tell them the plot. And then, like, 15 minutes would go by, and I'd be sort of, like, going over what I'm going to say on the radio. And you'd just hear in the background, hi, I'm Peter. Have you ever seen a film called Master of Disguise? It stars a young chap called Dana Carvu. So that is a memory that has nothing to do with the film, other than the fact that someone else had seen the film. And then maybe my all-time number one film fact that I know is that Dana Carvey dresses up as this turtle guy, and it's a lot of makeup. It's like Rick Baker level makeup appliances.
Also, during those scenes, he has to say
turtle.
Says turtle because turtles don't really say anything. So he hasn't really thought of a character, but when someone asks him a question, he says turtle.
And I imagine,
as if it's like turtle.
Do you think the Turtle Club is a real place, or
I don't know.
Or did they invent a place called the Turtle Club for the film, and then he went, "Oh, a Turtle Club. I guess I've got to dress up as a turtle." I mean, it makes sense.
And say turtle.
It makes a bit more sense if there's an actual place called the Turtle Club. But if there's no place that's really called the Turtle Club, they've only invented this for the film. And the fact that the character isn't funny and doesn't work on any level is absolutely unforgivable.
But there's an idea where they've gone, this is the one.
The thing about this film is that none of the characters work. It's all awful. Yeah. But they've obviously edited every single sequence down to the bare minimum. The percentage of material that's meant that they deem usable.
It's bizarre because when you watch the deleted scenes, they are like, there's more stuff and it's no worse than anything that's in the film. And you go, why don't you just put it in? Because it doesn't, like, it's, at least that's a joke that the granddad was a dog all the way through. And it's like, it is so mental.
Oh, it is a real thing. The Turtle Club is a real thing.
And right. The film itself is probably an hour, 65 minutes. Of what you actually get that's film and not the opening credits or closing credits.
But they've gone, we can't use this. So but they can't cut any of the characters. They can't cut any of the bits because it doesn't work, because then it's like a TV pilot.
Yeah.
So they have to, it's just like this absolutely, but it's not like so bad it's good. It's just this crazy thing.
Bizarre.
But so the Turtle Club, the Ancient and Honourable Order of Turtles, International Association of Turtles, Turtle Club, or similar title, started as an informal drinking club between World War II pilots, self-described as an honourable drinking fraternity composed of ladies and gentlemen of the highest morals and good character. Right, and so to honour that, he's dressed up as a massive turtle, and he comes into the room, and you're right, turtles don't say anything. So he's like Mr. Turtle, and he comes in and goes, turtle, turtle.
At one point he bites a man's nose off, which is weird.
Yeah.
It's weird.
And
spits it back on his nose.
Again, everything that we're describing makes it sound like it's probably worth watching, and it's not.
It really isn't.
It's really not. It's less than the sum of its pathetic parts. So my favourite fact about Master of Disguise is, so he dresses up as his turtle, and it's a lot of makeup, and it's a lot of costume. And the scene that follows, it's probably 7 minutes of just
the whole film is
dead air, right? There's no there's no comedy value in it. It's not even funny. You can't even laugh at it. It's just bewildering, this film. But the favourite thing is that, so he's dressed up as a turtle. So from a filmmaking point of view, he would have had to get up really early. So I'm filming at the moment, and I have to get up at like 5:30 every morning to get the car. The car comes to drive me to the set and stuff like that. So if you're like The Rock, or if you're Mark Wahlberg, you're getting up at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and you're going to the gym before you do all of that. And then you're having breakfast and all of that before you get onto the set. And if you're kind of like doing, if you've got like heavy prosthetics, then you're getting up maybe like 3-4 o'clock in the morning. You're getting into the makeup chair. Makeup is like, it was like a 5-hour thing, especially if there's so many prosthetics in it. Mm-hmm. If you're doing something like Harry and the Hendersons, you know, that one, because they don't really use prosthetics anymore. and this is probably part of the problem, but if you're something like, oh yeah, so Mark Wahlberg gets up at 2:30 in the morning. I mean, he's a deplorable human being. Yeah. One of the worst. He's one of the worst human beings that's at the top of the Hollywood chain. And if you don't know what I'm talking about, just Google Mark Wahlberg. But you know, yet his career goes on, and I'm not just talking about The Happening. So, and yeah, he's good in The Departed. He is. But that doesn't necessarily apologise for the mistakes in the past. He's literally gone on record and said that his worst film is Boogie Nights. And you go, that's your best film, Mark. That is your best film.
He's disowned it.
That's the only reason that you're still part of the conversation. Yeah, it's because you made Boogie Nights.
Otherwise, you were just Marky Mark in the 90s.
Who'd made Fear, and then what you know, Boogie Nights started your career. And I've just got to hand over some keys. Do you know what? I'll play a song and then I will tell you my favourite fact about Master of Disguise.
Yeah.
Hang on. What's the song that I'm going to play? We'll be right back.
you're going to die.
Anyway, here we are. We're back. Still eating bacon. Anyway, so Dana Carvey would have got up. We're talking about Master of Disguise. We're live talking about Master of Disguise.
It's 2019. We're talking about 2002's Master of Disguise.
So they were filming Master of Disguise, and he's got this Turtle Club scene. So Dana Carvey gets up bright and early, and he goes into makeup. He sits down.
3 a.m.-ish.
3 a.m. They start applying the makeup. They, you know, he's got to wear a bald cap, and then they put makeup over it. He's got loads of prosthetics. He's got to put this costume on. You know, people are coming in having their coffee.
Doesn't matter though, because it's going to look great when it's
on screen.
It's going to
look great. We'll work on the dialogue. But
have a think about that while you're in makeup.
Everyone's sitting there. They've highlighted their sides for the day, and they're just trying to learn their lines. Sides are miniature scripts that you have that just contain the pages that you're going to do that day. And everyone's learning their lines. They're making small talk in the morning, and then about like 9 o'clock. Two planes crash into the Twin Towers. It's September 11th, 2001. Everyone on set is horrified by the events, as we were all over the world.
Of course.
But after about probably 45 minutes of stunned silence, reality kicks in and...
There's a lot of money going
into these prosthetics, Dana. We're probably going to still have to record this Turtle Club sequence. And so when you watch The Master of Disguise, and you will watch it, when you watch The Master of Disguise, just in the back of your mind, remember that the whole Turtle Club sequence was filmed on September 11th, 2001, while the nation... That probably explains why it's not funny.
Yeah.
It's because he's there dressed up in all these prosthetics. He must have... He would have found out about... The terror attacks of 2011, dressed up as a giant turtle. He would have turned up and gone, "Well, what's going on, guys?"
And then he's gone, "I can just go, yeah. Just go, start, just action."
It would have been like that bit when David Brent gets fired while he's wearing the ostrich legs. Only real. I mean, you never guess what's happened, Dana. September 11th.
Well, they wouldn't know that as a thing.
Wouldn't have been calling it September 11th on September 11th. Unless they were in on the job. And I'm judging by the film, I'm not ruling them out. Master of Disguise is its own terrorist attack.
It's quite something. It's quite something.
I just think it's absolutely... When you see how bad that sequence is, it maybe does... explain it a little bit, but they use it in the trailer.
I would say as well,
just cut it.
The opening
cut it. Don't film. Don't try and do a sequence where you're dressed up as a giant turtle.
You don't need to have all those characters
in mourning.
But I think it's because they haven't filmed enough. It's like they can't really cut any of the characters. They can't go, that one doesn't really work.
They can't cut the characters. So what they have to do is they have to just edit them down to their bare minimum.
Yeah,
and then sort of like whack them together. But it's just an awful film. Anyway. Master of Disguise. Should we? What have I seen?
Have you been a fan of this week, Nick?
I watched Peeping Tom.
Oh yeah, yeah. I love that film
for the first time. It's really weird, isn't it? It's Michael Powell, director of Powell and Pressburger fame.
That's right.
Pressburger.
Yeah.
And they did
Matter of Life and Death.
Matter of Life and Death, and The Red Shoes, and loads of films. I've got a box set, but I've never seen Peeping Tom, and. It's difficult to pin it. When you watch it, it's difficult to pin a date on it because it's so ahead of its time. It's so modern and pretty hardcore.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it doesn't look new.
Yeah. And it sort of looks like classic. It's got that very classic
classic. And so I watched both of Hitchcock's 1970s. I watched Frenzy and
Frenzy. Absolutely love Frenzy.
It's just got a really weird tone to it.
It's so
a comedy.
Grim.
It's a comedy. Like okay, so I watched Alfred Hitchcock's 1972 film.
Yeah.
Frenzy. What was the fucking other film that I watched with
Family Plot.
Bruce Dern, Family Plot. Never seen either of those films. Family Plot was Alfred Hitchcock's last film. It's almost a bit like... it's got a very TV quality to it.
Yeah, I was going to say, it feels like a TV movie.
Feels like a pilot or like an episode of Alfred Hitchcock's Presents,
exactly.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But aesthetically, if you don't know what that is, aesthetically, it's like an episode of Columbo. Mm. And it's got the same sort of tone to it. It's mm-hmm. very light, very frothy, and apparently it was based on a really dark book. And the original script was pretty dark, and Hitchcock was just like, I don't want to do anything really dark. I think he'd just probably done Frenzy.
Because it is so dark. And I think that was
Frenzy.
Like, that was a thing where I think when, at the time, people were saying that, well, Hitchcock's good, he's a good director, but he's from a different era. And now we're making, like, much kind of harder films. And he's like, I can absolutely do a film like you do films.
Yeah.
And he does this.
But he goes in too hard.
Yeah, it's really. I love it. I think it's brilliant. I think it's a proper...
I wouldn't say that I love it, but I've only just seen it.
Yeah.
I do love Hitchcock.
I've seen it millions of times. And it is, it's funny, but the jokes come from, like, the bleakest kind of horrible moments. And, like, it's got...
Well, yeah.
Trying to sort of spoilers, I suppose, but trying to break a woman's finger that he's murdered to remove the
whole sequence
thing.
On the potato van is just stupid.
Oh, I love it. I think it's right.
What I would say is, when you look at the films that other people were making at that time, so you look at Alfred Hitchcock, thank you very much. I've just had some tea delivered.
So have I.
I said we've just had some tea delivered. I wasn't... Oh, you were telling the listeners. I thought you felt like I was excluding you.
No.
Never exclude you. although I haven't offered you any bacon. There's too much bacon. I've got the bacon sickness. The last time I had that was when I ate one of those party bags of Frazzles. But even that, that liquefies in your throat, isn't it? Because it's just basically cornstarch. And when you're sick on Frazzles, Marks and Spencer's own brand Frazzles, it just comes out as a paste. So, bacon paste. The films that were made at the same time as I would say, so Family Plot is Hitchcock's last film, and he wanted to make something light and frothy. I think it was probably to get over the fact that he'd just made Frenzy. And
it's like a black comedy.
Yeah, and I would say it's better than what's that really fucking awful one that he made with Paul Newman in? That Torn Curtain.
Oh yeah, that's quite hard going, isn't it?
It's just boring.
It's like a spy thriller.
It's better than some of his worst films.
But then if you think of, like, So's North by Northwest is a spy thriller. Absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and actually North by Northwest has got the same light and frothiness, but I like. Do you know what? I really liked Family Plot, but it was so nothingy. Mm. And I think North by Northwest could have been that, but North by Northwest is my favourite. Mm. But then it's got Cary Grant, and Cary Grant is incredible.
Frenzy's got Bernard Cribbins in it.
Well, so Frenzy, when you look at the films that were made, Texas Chainsaw Massacre was made 2 years later.
Yeah, yeah.
Dario Argento was making films at that time. I guess Brian De Palma had started making films at that time. So there was... So basically, tonally, Alfred Hitchcock has made a 1970s movie.
Mm.
But visually, he's made like an early 60s film. It looks so... It doesn't look contemporary.
No.
It doesn't look like it was made in 1972. Everyone looks like they're dressed from the 60s. It's still got very much London, Carnaby Street, swinging 60s sort of vibe to it.
But it does still have a lot of kind of very signature sort of Hitchcocky things where you go, oh, that's really nice.
Yeah, I mean, you can... Mind you, I was thinking when I was... Because I write these little... Twitter reviews where they have to fit in. It's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Trying to fit them into the word count,
yeah,
or the character count. But and one of the things I was going to say is you could have told me. Maybe I was going to say it about Family Plot, but you no, because I don't know. You could Family Plot just feels like a TV thing, but you could have told me anyone directed Frenzy, and I probably would have believed you. I didn't really feel. But then I watched the making of afterwards, and then it sort of like highlighted some bits where you go, I suppose that is all classic Hitchcock. What's just weird about it is how dated it looks, and yet It's just like this kind of like swinging 60s kind of movie with a 1970s
grime and
meanness
yeah,
to it.
It's really mean-spirited.
It's mean-spirited, and it's mainly played for laughs, but yeah. like pitch black laughs.
Yeah, that's it. I think that's what saves it, though. Like, I think it's like it's so mean-spirited, and yet it's got these sort of like laughs and jokes and.
So the potato basically murders a woman, and then he realizes that she's got a bit of evidence on her, and he's got to go and get it, and he's. He's basically trying
to break open a woman's fingers.
He's going through all the sacks of potatoes on a moving potato van. The killer is, because he can't find which one the body's in. And when he finds her, because she's got rigor mortis, her legs keep kicking him in the face. Yeah. And it's all played for sort of funny. Like, it's like Confessions of a Window Cleaner laughs.
Yeah, it's really
do you know
funny.
What I mean? It's like really light. And then he finds it, and then he breaks her hand open to get the evidence out of it. And it's like all like cracks and stuff. And it's just, but he's like pulling, he's like gurning, like he's doing all of the, what's the guy that used to be in Confessions of a Window
Robin Cleaner? Asquith.
It's like gurning. Like Robin Asquith, and it's the same era as well. It's just really
maybe anyway, this is why I like it.
My favorite, I think the most WTF moment in Frenzy, and
spoiler.
I think the most fucking what the fuck moment in Frenzy. WTF. I think we should probably get a Mark Simmons or Joey Page in to do a WTF. Yeah. Or maybe just snip that bit out and we'll use that. Hang on, I'll do it now.
Go for it.
WTF. Oh. you do one as well.
No, I don't want to.
We'll just cut it out and we'll use it as a button.
I don't want to say WTF.
Say it.
WTF.
We'll use that one. You heard it here first, people. I was just about to dip my bacon in my tea. Not going to do that. I end up with greasy tea.
Greasy.
It's not greasy enough. Not nearly greasy enough. is the running gag where the police detective's wife is doing a
she's doing a cookery course,
a cuisine course.
I love it. I think it's so great.
Yeah, but basically, one of the opening shots of the main detective is that he's eating a full English breakfast and he's just like eating it like ravenously while they're discussing this
horrible murder.
Yeah. And he's like going something like not eating at home. He goes, oh bloody hell, the wife's doing a cuisine course, and all this French muck, right? And it's got such a xenophobic attitude to all this food. It's like, what are we eating tonight? And she's going, oh, we're having bouillabaisse. And he goes home and his wife is cooking, and he's got this three-course meal that she's made, and she serves him like fish stew, and it's just got all fish heads in it. And what I think is just absolutely genius about all of these scenes is their exposition, their expository, what's the word I'm looking for?
Exposition-y.
They're scenes full of exposition. Where basically they're just telling you the plot. They're telling you...
what's happened so far.
So the police detective has basically gone home and his wife says, how was your day? And then the police detective goes on to tell his wife the plot of the film so far and what the police are going to do about it.
And what the police know and what they don't.
But the story of the scene is that the police detective doesn't want to eat his wife's cooking. So he's telling his wife about his day... all through the fact that she's in the kitchen and he's trying to scrape his food back into the dish that she served it out of. And then they play like this, all of this deep, it's just all exposition and stuff, right? They're playing all of this dense information over this light comedy.
While discussing like... murders, these stranglers.
These stranglers. But also, it's this thing where they do it quite a few times in the scene where at the very beginning, there are these two guys sat at the bar talking about the murders and the plot of the murders and who they think it is. While there's this other scene that's playing out visually in the foreground. And I just thought, I've never really noticed that about Hitchcock before. I've never really noticed it in a lot of films before. I guess you do it sometimes in action films where you're in a car chase and you're driving really fast and the guy turns around. It's always the guy turning around to the woman and he turns around and he says, "This is what's going on." And it happens in Terminator when they're in a... James Cameron does it really well in the first Terminator where Sarah Connor and Kyle Reese are driving away from the Terminator, and while they're driving away in this car chase, Kyle Reese tells Sarah Connor the plot of the film. And you don't really realise that if everything had stopped and they just told you the plot of the film, you'd go, this is boring. But because they do it in a car chase, you go, it's just a really clever way of doing it. And but it's not a car chase. It's light comedy in Frenzy. And it's just this thing that I've not really seen before. But what's really weird about it is that after he finishes the fish soup course, he goes, well, I didn't think you'd want much, so I made some quail. And quail is delicious. Like, it's just basically these mini roast chickens. And he's rolling his eyes like it's the most disgusting thing.
It's the 70s, Nick.
And he goes,
I just don't know what this food
and
is.
But it's a running joke. So it happens like 3 or 4 times throughout the film. So a bit later, he goes, what's for dinner tonight? And she goes, oh, I thought we'd have... she says something in French. And he goes, what's that? And he goes, it's duck. And he's like... like he's going to vomit in his mouth. And then a bit later on... one of the detectives comes in and she goes, would you like a drink? And he goes, well, I wouldn't mind a drink. And she goes, brilliant, I'll make you a margarita. What's a margarita? Yeah. Well, it's tequila, because it's a new word back then. She goes, it's tequila, lemon juice, and a rim of salt along the glass. And he goes, oh, and he's like, oh, God, I'm not going to like the sound of this. And then she makes him the drink, and then he avoids drinking it for the scene. And then he goes, I'm terribly sorry, I've got to die. She goes, but you haven't drank your drink. And then she drinks it, and then she looks like she's going to be sick. And it's just like anything foreign in the film is unacceptable. And the only thing that you're allowed to eat in 1970s England is a full English breakfast. And there's one bit when he just wakes up, or he's lying in bed. No, he's not. He's lying on the sofa, and he pours himself a glass of wine, and he drinks a little bit of wine, and then he gets up. And as he gets up, he just picks up half a pork pie that's just sat on the table, eats that, and then licks his fingers on his way to look through a curtain. And you go like, so in the 70s, all people were eating.
We say this, but there's that TV show where Ainsley Harriott has to make Len Goodman eat a spaghetti bolognese. And that's
spaghetti bolognese. I'm not eating that muck.
That's a show on TV now.
What's this? What you call this?
A pizza. It's a pizza.
Chicken sweet and sour. Chicken sweet and sour. No, I'm not eating this spice. Spicy muck. Spicy.
Great show then.
Great legs.
Len Goodman. They're judging someone's dance in there. Just bring up to mind, you know, who we let judge our dancing. And one of them is Len Goodman. Let's read some fan mail. I'll turn that down. So, this is a very brief one. This is from Leech Scoff. Pretty good. 5 stars. That was the heading. And now the full body of the review.
Yeah.
Pretty darn good.
Pretty good. Pretty darn good. Okay.
That's Leech Coffee did that on Saturday. That's the fan club. Not quite the phrase there, but that's from Mark Granger. 5 stars. I've been meaning to write a review of this for ages. Right being as in right or wrong, as opposed to write a sonnet. A fantastic show that's all about celebrating the things we love. Just a 2-sentence review there. One of the sentences was spelt incorrectly and really did leave us hanging for a 3rd sentence that we could really hang our hat on. Hello to all the fan club crew. I would say hello to Nick and Nat. The rest of the fan club crew really just wait for something to go wrong and then fix it in their own time. So here's some airplane inspired fan art. There's a lot going on here, but if you look carefully, is this what they read? this is what they wrote. There's a lot going on here, but if you look carefully, Dr. Rumack, Leslie Nielsen, has popped in to tell Ned, to tell Ted,
Nat,
and Elaine, Nick. I'm Elaine. Thank you for making me Elaine. Good luck. We're all counting on you. I hope this brightens your day a little, maybe.
It's a good piece of great piece of fan art.
That's Neve Gurr.
And that features Stephen Seagal.
You've got Stephen Seagal there. You've got...
Ridley Scott.
I'm here too.
RTDT in the background.
RTD2. And what's that in the corner? Is that something that we talked about? Did we have another character that came up last week that we never used?
Possibly. We are producing characters at a rate now.
Why don't you write in and tell us what your favourite character is?
From Fan Club.
It can be favourite character of all time, but we are specifically asking for a character that only comes from Fan Club.
Your favourite Fan Club based character?
Of all time.
Of all time.
But your favourite character of all time that could also happen to be originated in our show, Fan Club.
We've also had another great bit of fan art from Nick. It's been sent in, Nick. And there's a long letter which I don't know if I can.
I love it, Nick. I do question why you've not filled our faces in and we've
just got blank.
You've shaded over them. I do love it.
No
but
face.
It's also slightly sinister. But that's Fan Club!
You look like the murderer in Mario Bava's Blood and Black Lace.
Yes, that's exactly what we look. That's exactly what we look like. Yes, we look like the murderers in Mario Bava's Blood and Black Lace.
That's Fan Club.
That's what we look like. Did you see that? Did you see the barber shop down the road from me called Mario's Barbers?
Yes.
and it really made my day. And I thought, I wonder if anyone else has noticed that Mario's Barbers is almost exactly the same name as Mario Bava, of course, the director of Black Sunday, Black Sabbath.
Blood and Black Lace.
Bay of Blood. Was that Bay of Blood?
Bay of Blood. Danger Diabolik.
Danger Diabolik. And of course, the killer from Blood and Black Lace also looks a little bit like the character The Blank from the Dick Tracy movie.
Yes, or The Question from the DC Universe of comics.
Or a little bit like Rorschach from The Watchmen. Without the ink going all over his face and moving.
It was based on The Question.
Was he really? That's Fan Club. It all connects in a way. Thanks, Nick. That's beautiful. It's beautiful. We've got a letter there, but we'll read it during the song. We're going to play a song now, and then we're going to go next door and get our guest. See if you can guess who it is. We've already tweeted about it. It's no surprise. but if you can guess, it's John Robbins during the music. Then
well done.
Then write in and tell us who you think it is. And there's a big prize coming. It'll be 342 copies of my first album, Hot and Heavy. I've just moved house and I'm trying to get rid of some merchandise.
And perhaps a DVD of Master of Disguise.
What's your song?
What is it this week? It's
Friday on My Mind by the Easy Beats.
It is.
Monday morning feels so bad. Everybody seems to nag me. Coming Tuesday, I feel better. Even my old man looks good. Wednesday just don't go. Else that burns me.
Club on FUBAR Radio.
Nah. John's headphones are too loud. But just so you know, you don't have to wear the headphones, John. It's absolutely fine.
I think I'd feel strange if I wasn't.
Hmm. Yeah, no, I do too, because it feels like you're just having a chat and the headphones remind you that you're on air and you're being professional.
Simon Mayo always says he knows when he's got a guest who's taking it seriously because they whack the old cans on.
Oh, really?
Also, where's the front of this mic?
The front of the mic is where it has the...
It's a little arrow that's there. No, but don't move the actual phone bit, because the phone bit is pointing at that camera there so that they can see that they are on FUBAR Radio. It's branded. It's a branded mic. You can hear. Exactly. You heard it here first. That's a mic adjustment.
There you go.
Where is John Robbins' headphones volume control on here? To the right of mine. Now, which one is mine? Mine is the silver. How about that?
Perfect. Is that right? Actually, a little bit louder than that, thank
you. Can I have mine a little bit louder as well, please?
How about that? Does that work?
Yes.
Does that work?
Thank you very much.
Apologies if at home I've changed your volume. I don't think that's possible. Anyway, we're joined in the studio now by comedian and now author.
Oh, yeah.
John Robbins.
Yeah. Thank you for saying that. No one said that before.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I have. I'm into books, mate.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, a lot of my doors shut very easily, and I'm always looking for a doorstop.
Yeah,
that's a little joke. I don't read. I do read. I love reading. Normally on my phone.
Are you nervous being on the radio, John?
I'm nervous having him on.
I'm so nervous being on the radio. It's scary.
How's your radio show?
Good, man. Yeah, it's great fun.
Yeah,
got that tomorrow.
Yeah, every Saturday.
Every Saturday.
You heard it here first, people. It's every Saturday
one till
on...
4. Radio X.
Radio X.
Radio X.
Is that XFM?
It used to be XFM.
It's XXFM.
Yes.
Nice.
Thank you.
There you go.
I'll be listening in tomorrow to see if you use any of this gold.
Will do.
So you're going to go... So you're doing Edinburgh?
Big time.
Doing a whole month?
Uh-huh.
What venue?
Pleasance One.
Pleasance One.
Lovely.
And you are going on tour after that?
That's correct. From September to November with my show Hot Shame.
And have you written it yet?
I've written a show, but that'll probably get...
You've got length.
Yeah, I need more girth.
Girth.
That is such a good analogy.
Yes.
I've got... I could be on stage and talk for an hour, but it wouldn't satisfy the audience.
Yeah,
so
yeah, right.
I'll probably bin that, write another one, and then use the best of the two.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Is that how you do it?
Not before, but I've never been in this position before of having, like, an hour of stuff by March, so I don't want to get bored of it.
Is that because you did it? You didn't do Edinburgh last year, so were
no,
you writing the whole time?
Not at all.
Oh, so you, okay, right. So I didn't do Edinburgh last year. I didn't even go up. And so you didn't do Edinburgh last year, you didn't go up...
I went up for a couple of days
right.
to hand out the Edinburgh Comedy Award with hero, Mr. Steve Coogan. So that was a great moment.
Oh, what's he like?
Lovely, really nice.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Do you find, you were watching this new series of
I guess
Alan Partridge.
It wasn't. I guess it wasn't a work environment, that's fine. So, Partridge.
Yeah. Do you find you are influenced by Partridge when you listen to it?
Yeah.
Can you then undo it?
Probably more than anything else.
Yeah.
So I've my best friend and I can kind of speak. We can actually talk about our lives just in Partridge quotes.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
sometimes that does spill over into the radio show.
How did we get onto this? When you're on your radio show, do you feel like you talk like Partridge? Is this what your question
no,
was?
No, I was saying that I was talking about you last week whenever Partridge started, that you couldn't get it out of your...
When did you start talking about that? Have I just missed, like, 5 minutes of chat?
I've just introduced it. Well, I know John is a Partridge fan.
Yes, big time.
And that it will influence your speech as it does when you listen to Partridge. It's very difficult to not start talking like Partridge.
Because when the new series started we did the first one the Friday after, I couldn't stop talking like him. I do it all the time. I've done it ever since we started doing the radio show. I slip into it. But then last week, the 2 weeks ago was particularly bad.
But there is that funny thing when you're on the radio where you almost feel like you're always doing a sort of radio voice. Or you feel like there's a half... It's half joking that then becomes actual, just the way you speak on the radio.
Especially when I think you're on like a commercial station because you the structure of the show sounds so much like... Mid-Morning Matters
yeah,
or
sure.
North Norfolk Digital or
we
whatever.
We don't really know about that. We're on FUBAR. and we are fucked up beyond all recognition, mate. So
this is why they've got us to.
We don't know what it's like working for the man.
Well, it's the same, but we don't F and Jeff or broadcast the sound of people eating bacon. Because, and I have to say, having listened to it in the little anteroom, it's really disgusting. It's like the worst possible thing you could do on the radio.
We are fucked up beyond all recognition, mate.
The last time I came on FUBAR was with Peacock and Gamble, which dates it. And they were like, yeah, I wouldn't want to be on a proper radio. Well, like, Bolsworth was like, I wouldn't want to be on a proper radio station. We can say whatever we like. You just end up talking about paedophiles for 10 minutes. And you're like, well, there's a reason.
I think that is an
error. I'm going to have to take my headphones off if you continue to eat bacon into the microphone.
Look, mate, you've got eyes. You can see I've only got one bit left.
There's probably only another 10 minutes of this, John.
There are people who have, like, sort of deep-seated phobias of the sound of people eating, isn't there?
Mm.
Mm. I can
but
see that.
But there's also websites that you can go on to listen to it specifically.
There could be an ASMR track, couldn't there, someone eating bacon?
I think that's the opposite of ASMR.
I've done it, all right? For you. For you. I wasn't even hungry at that point. I just had to force that last piece of bacon down.
Sometimes, and this is another very Partridge thing, like when a track is coming to an end on Radio X, Ellis will have a piece of mango in his mouth. And there's that really, it's always really funny when someone's kind of... That was Coldplay.
That's what happens. It's normally with tea. And you just, yeah. But I'll choke on it, and then that'll be the start of the show.
Your radio show is in. I didn't know where that sentence was going. You could tell. Your radio show is very successful. How do you do a successful radio show, John?
So we put you on here to ask you a question.
How do you do radio?
I would say what is good for us is that the show is sort of, because it's split into sections, it is edited in itself. So when it comes out in a podcast, that editing, even though you don't play the songs and the adverts and stuff, is reflected in the fact that you sort of you're not dwelling on something for too long, I guess. And at first you find that difficult because you think, oh, why do we have to play a song after 4 minutes, or why can't we just talk? And then you're like, well, actually, that it means we get to a punchline. And I think the producers are really great at that, is like telling you where the out, well, sort of you learn where the out is.
So tip one is get good producers.
Yeah, but also, like, the good thing about having, you know, adverts and songs and news is that it forces you to sort of keep it tight, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Keep it tight.
We don't have that problem, really. We just ramble. This is probably why Natalie initially wanted us to have more features and
we
things.
Do have...
Features are good for that.
We
features
do have a lot of structure. We do have a lot of structure to our show. It's just invisible structure.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
We do half an hour of chatting about our week, song. Then half an hour of gearing up to the first guest, where we kind of like do fan mail and stuff like that. And then if we have an extra guest, we'll have them on for 15 minutes. Then Nat's song. First song is my song, an Alice Cooper song.
How many songs do you play here?
We play three or four songs. Three or four. Sometimes it's four.
An hour?
Two hours. So two songs an hour. Then we have the guest on, which is you today, but not always you, as you know, because you've not done it before. Don't be nervous. And then we talk to them for like, just like, what are you up to? Have you got anything to promote for about half an hour? Then we play their song. Then we talk to them about what they're really interested in.
Oh,
then
great.
Then we play a game.
Oh, lovely. Well,
and
that's exciting.
And then we wrap it up. So there is some structure there. But what are your other two? I'm just like saying that we're ahead of the game on your list so far. Hmm. We know what we're doing. And we've got an excellent producer. She's not in today, though. So we've got Nat and... Natalie's an excellent producer. So what else should we do to get your sort of figures?
It takes time,
very popular.
Man. It takes time.
We've been doing this for a while.
You've got to,
we've done it for almost a year now.
You've got to, in a sense...
Still not got half viewing figures in.
You know, it's like that thing Van Morrison said, you've got to speak as if nobody's listening, but then also bear in mind that people are listening. So it's an odd mix of trying to be as natural as possible, but also thinking about the fact that you've got, you know, thousands of individual little relationships going with the people at any one time. Mayo is the king at that, I think.
Mm. Why? What's Mayo do? What's his?
Because he's got the listener in mind, but it also sounds like he's having a conversation with someone else. So you sort of almost always feel he's talking to you whilst talking to the other person. It's very, very skillful.
And will there be another person there? Are you talking about solo mayo?
Well, if you take, for example, like...
mayo out the jar.
Either. But when, for example, Mayo and Kermode, he is your... He's you in
he's
that
your
room.
Entry point.
Yeah. I just, okay. It's very deft.
He's the audience identifying figure.
Yes.
I do think that... Yeah, because I do find that... I watched Mark Kermode's reviews online, and I do find that relationship quite odd in terms of the fact that Simon Mayo and Mark Kermode reviewing films, and Simon Mayo seems to have next to no or little either interest or knowledge about any of the films they're talking about.
Well, he has the same interest or knowledge as we do.
No.
Not you, because you talked about a Brett Spiner film for 25 minutes before eating bacon.
This is the show.
But
you can't judge the show while you're on the show. Just dive in, enjoy the experience, and afterwards regret it.
No, but no, what I'm saying is that you have a higher understanding of films than most people I know.
Yeah. Yes, but I've got the same knowledge of films that most people I know have of football.
So I have the same experience of films as Simon Mayo, but I have all the opinions of films of Mark Kermode,
right,
which means I don't have to go and watch films.
And also, I guess that does make for a better thing, doesn't it? Because we just go, yes, I have seen that film that no one else has seen, rather than going, I haven't seen that, tell me about that film.
Well, when I did say that I hadn't seen a film, you two, you and Jim Hoskins, proceeded to talk for 15 minutes without including me in the conversation at all. Nice. If you listen back to that episode, I was sat in silence, just like going, yeah, but... and then I gave up. Okay. Because I just said, I haven't seen that film. He goes, oh, well, you probably wouldn't like it. And I said, no. I tried to explain the concept to the show. So if you haven't heard of something, that's not a bad thing. Just explain it, for fuck's sake. I mean, most people haven't seen Master of Disguise, but we went and fucking explained it to
every
the point.
Every time you drop an F-bomb, I wince because I think I'm about to get sacked.
Don't be a cunt, mate.
Oh, my God.
Nah,
outrageous.
This is Trousers Down Entertainment. You're listening to Nick and Nat's Fuck Club. First rule of Fuck Club is fuck.
Has either you or Ellis ever done a swear?
By accident?
Of course.
Oh. On air?
No. We've come close and we sort of had to... We found a way of moving the beginning syllable of swear words into family-friendly phrases.
Okay.
So...
Like family-friendly phrases. So, family-friendly phrases.
So the F became a lot of fridge-based chat. The best one was when Ellis went, oh, big rolls on a plate at a funeral. And the C bomb became coin, so we will call someone a coin on the show to sort of replicate that, but in a way that doesn't put the image too sternly in the listener's mind.
Ellis James is one of possibly the funniest people I've ever met in the real world. How's it like working with him?
Well, he's never really shown me that side of himself. I think probably to boost my ego.
I remember the first time I met Ellis was in Wales after a gig. Maybe it was a Brecon gig for Henry Widdicombe. Josh Widdicombe was there. I was there. Maybe Henry Widdicombe was there. Sean Harries was in the house. And Ellis hadn't been at the gig, but he was in his pants.
What? At the gig?
No, he hadn't been at the gig. He was at home.
Okay.
Because they were all sharing a house at the time. And we'd all got in from the gig, and he was sort of like in between bed and making himself a cup of tea. And he'd come down to say hello, and he was sort of like in his boxer shorts, ready for bed. And he stood in the doorway of the living room, leaning on the doorknob. And he basically talked for maybe 15 minutes, half an hour. And it was the funniest thing I've...
Oh, he can talk, man. He's the chatter.
It was just incredible. Just the funniest. And I was just quiet in the corner. Enjoying it. What a man.
Great man, great guy, lovely guy.
But you're here, so we'll make the best of the cards that God has dealt us.
If we go back to the very early days of your XFM, was it always Radio X?
No, it was XFM at the start.
XFM. If you go back to the early days, John, were you like, did you see this as a thing where I'm going to put your stamp on it? Or was it something that you thought about a lot and I'm going to really put all my cards into this show? Or was it something that has grown organically week by week and become the behemoth of radio that it is now?
That's very kind. It it pretty much, I think what's happened over the last 5 years is we've learned how to do radio. But I think when we first started, we had a relationship together based on conversations, like you say, like Ellis talking for 10 minutes is so funny, and we would have sort of weekly conversations on the phone while we were just circuit acts, you know, moaning about gigs or talking about other comedians and agents and all that sort of stuff. And we enjoyed those conversations so much that it seemed natural that we, when I moved to London, that's what we wanted to do, is to do radio. And also we're both big radio fans. But I think then we had to sort of over time evolve a way of squeezing that into a format. And but then so much of it has just happened by accident, really, in terms of like running jokes and catchphrases and all the sort of interaction with the fans and things, and then the live stuff and then the book. So we never thought any of that would happen. But I think we knew that if we found our conversations funny, other people might find them funny as well.
And how? So you did a book tour.
Yeah.
And you're both stand-ups. So was it? We've had other people. We've had authors that have done book tours that aren't stand-ups, and they basically say they just read a bit from their book and then they signed their book. How did you and Alice find
well,
your book tour?
Well, we'd done one live tour before that wasn't book-based, so that was kind of, you know, bits of the show, not like redone, but sort of doing them live. And anecdotes and stuff.
Did you ever see Newman and Badil do that? They did a Newman and Badil stand-up gig, and it was just at the time of Mary Whitehouse Experience, or maybe it was Newman and Badil in Pieces. And I think it was called History Today was the name of the tour, and they'd come on at the end and do History Today. But all the way through, they were sort of apologising throughout the whole gig, saying, well, we did this bit of material on Monday, but you might have seen this on telly on Monday. But then, but this is basically the gist of the material. Well, quite an awkward hour.
Yeah, no. What's nice about the when we do it is we can sort of, to an extent, do little behind the scenes stuff. So stuff we couldn't say on the radio, maybe, or stories behind certain events. So there was an episode, for example, where our old producer Dave had this live read we had to do. So every so often you get a piece of paper saying, today you can win a Samsung Galaxy or whatever that. And it was a promotion with Chang beer. Okay, so already he's got an alarm bell there. John can't be in charge of this because it's Chang, right? And he's going to make a joke. Secondly, is the competition was to win a holiday to Phuket, right, in Thailand. Mm-hmm. Second alarm bell going off in Dave's mind, Chang, Phuket.
Interesting spelling as well.
Yes, spelling pronunciation issues here. So he goes, I want Ellis to do this. And I'm like, well, whatever, mate. I'm too dangerous.
Yeah.
So he explains to Ellis about three times while the song is playing, it's pronounced Phuket, right? It's Chang beer, but they're paying for this, so don't mess about. And Ellis is fine, safe hand on the tiller, all that. So anyway, the track ends, and I can see that while Dave's been explaining this, Ellis has been on his phone underneath, looking at, like, Neil Kinnock's Wikipedia page or something. So the mics go down, and Ellis goes, that was Green Day. Anyway, now we're giving away a trip to Fuck It. And, like, Dave's face exploded, and Ellis was like, what? What I thought it was being... That's what you said, wasn't it? And he was like, no, that was actually the opposite of what I said.
And not so on air, though.
Mics, yeah, on air. So mics go down, track goes on, and he's like, what the hell are you doing? Mics go back up, and I say...
Did he think he was doing it on purpose to be a bit...
No, he knew that he was being an idiot,
right?
But not on purpose. And then when the mics go back up, I say, well, that's what you get for trusting Ellis, Dave. All I was going to say is, here at Radio X, we love a night out on the Chang. He went ballistic because I intentionally did that.
Yeah, sure.
Whereas Ellis's was a mistake.
But the thing
so
is,
we can, when we are live, we can tell that whole story to the audience who heard it.
But the thing is, he legitimately mispronounced Phuket. Is that how you spell it?
Yeah, after being told three times.
Yeah,
how
but he
to
wasn't
pronounce
listening,
it.
Right? And, no, had he not explained, had it not been explained to him, he would have done it the same anyway, right? Yeah. He would have just said fuck it.
Yeah, but if you say to someone three times, it's pronounced Phuket, not fuck it. It's pronounced Phuket, not fuck it.
Yeah, but what I mean is that the general audience will, if they don't know it's pronounced Phuket, will have assumed that he meant fuck it anyway, right? They're not thinking that he's saying fuck it.
No.
They're
but
thinking
it's still...
he's saying. It's just a word that sounds. It's just a name that sounds like a couple of words, right?
Yeah, but
I
also
think that's absolutely.
But it's problematic because it's part of sort of sponsored content. So what happens is at the end of an advertising campaign, all of those clips will be sent to the advertiser to go, "Here's what you paid us for."
Yeah, well, do you know what? Chang Beer. They've already called themselves Chang Beer, so probably don't do a promotional holiday to fuck it. Do you know what I mean? Just pick anywhere else. Have you ever had Chang Beer?
I have, yeah.
It's fucking incredible. It numbs your tongue.
Really?
They did a load of it in Machynlleth the other
did
year.
They?
And I was drinking so much Chang beer, and basically the bottom half of my face went all numb.
I don't remember it being particularly.
Yeah, it's kind of like got this. And the other one is Qing Tao. They sell it's a Chinese beer, and that's absolutely delicious, and that numbs your tongue. I guess there's some sort of
maybe is it the alcohol that's numbing your tongue? Maybe
I think it's the cocaine that they stuff in. No, because I drink Foster's all the time, and that never numbs my tongue. Here's a quick question for you: Jennifer Garner married which Hollywood star in 2005?
No idea.
I've got it.
Come on, you must know.
No. Nope.
Jennifer Garner married which Hollywood star in 2005?
I don't even know who Jennifer Garner is.
Okay, I'll give you the multiple choice. Is it A, Tom Hanks, B, Matt Damon, C, Leonardo DiCaprio, or D, Ben Affleck?
Ben Affleck.
Yeah, of course it is.
Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Well done.
Well, you get another question now.
Okay, great.
That's your reward. The Shawshank Redemption is based on a book by which writer?
Stephen King, Rita Hayworth, and The Shawshank Redemption. I think I might be one of the few people my age who read the story before the film. So when the film came out, I was so excited.
And which, for a bonus point, which collection of books was that?
It was called Something Seasons, Don't Tell Me. Different Seasons?
If I knew the answer to that,
it's called Different Seasons.
I think it's called Something Seasons. And what were the other books in that?
Stand By Me.
Which was called
It was called Rita Hayworth and Stand By Me.
No. Was it called The Body?
Yeah, it might have been called The Body. And then there were two others. Autumn something.
Wasn't At People in there as well?
Possibly.
There was one about Nazis in there. I only know this because I had a conversation with someone about this in the week, and it's weird that it's just come up again.
Another weird thing about that is when I read Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption, I was getting deeply into Tubular Bells 2 by Mike Oldfield, which I still think is the best version of Tubular Bells.
Mike Oldfield there, not to be mistaken for Mark Oldfield, a kid I went to school with.
Yeah. I basically had it in my headphones the entire time I read that short story. So now, whenever I watch the film, I hear Tubular Bells 2 at certain points. And when I listen to Tubular Bells 2, I see bits of the film.
Have you ever thought of going on some sort of editing software and putting together a Tubular Bells Shawshank Redemption mashup?
Ooh, the copyright would be an absolute nightmare.
I think you're just right. Who's that actor? Topher Grace. He re-edited the original Star Wars trilogy into one mega movie.
Have you ever seen Tubular Bells for Two?
Tubular Bells for Two.
Yeah, I think it's called that, Tubular Bells for Two. So basically, these two Australian multi-instrumentalists do Tubular Bells live on stage in its entirety, all playing all the instruments. It's absolutely mind-blowing, right?
I should imagine that's a bit like one man Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, that sort of thing. So you come on stage, the lights are all sort of like uplit, and it starts, dun, 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 and you're just absolutely just sat there, and they hit every note, and they've got the tubular bells, they've got guitars, they've got basses, they've got effects loops, they've got everything, right? So 45 minutes of this. Then there's the bit on Tubular Bells where it says, now turn over the disc. They do that, and there's silence. And one of them stands up, this is in like a 800-seat venue in Edinburgh, goes, "So how's your festival going? Those bloody flyers on the Royal Mile." And you're like, no way! You're not going to do crap, bad, local, observational stuff. And just all the atmosphere just went vroom, out of the room. And he did about 2 minutes of really poor, like, kind of street performer chat. And then they turn the disc over and they do the rest. But one of the stupidest artistic
because I think it'd be nice to have the silence or just actually have the sound of a record turning over.
But absolutely.
Something.
Surely I couldn't believe
that
it.
That to me is okay. It's worth doing the Tubular Bell stuff just for that joke. Yeah. It's worth doing an hour and a half of Tubular Bells just because the Tubular Bells is incidental. It's literally just, this is the joke we're going to do. We're going to take something really seriously. And in the natural pause, we've got a cracking bit of shit stand-up that we're going to do, just to see the reaction on people's faces.
I like the idea that they only did that once. Yeah, and one of them was saying, I'm going to do that in the middle bit. And he goes, don't do it. And he goes, it'll be funny.
That is meta anti-comedy. Literally, they'll get them all there, and they'll think they're watching Tube of Bells, but really the joke's on them. And then we're going to carry on like it never happened. I think that's incredible. Topher Grace said, portraying David Duke left him feeling depressed. Oh, I don't give a shit about Topher Grace. All Black Klansmen, fucking hell, that film. I mean, it's got flaws, and nobody talks about the flaws. Anyway, how many parts make up The Hunger Game? I know you agree with me, Nat. How many parts make up The Hunger Game series of movies?
Didn't they split the last one into two?
Well, what will that make it then?
So five?
I'm going to give you the choices here.
It's four. I don't.
Yeah, it was four.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay. He's got on to the next round. What is the name of Jodie Foster's character in Taxi Driver? I don't know this, but I do now.
I don't know.
You can't do that.
A good question. Good question.
Okay, I'm going to give you the multiple choice here.
Okay.
Is it A, Iris? Is it B, Lily? Is it C, Emma?
It's Iris.
I think it's Iris.
Or D Rose, it was Iris.
Yeah.
Obviously, What is the first name of... It was too fucked up beyond all recognition while I was thinking there.
I'm glad you didn't
say
it.
What is the first name? All I'm saying is... I just find it kind of ridiculous that Adam Driver doesn't know all of the lies that Denzel Washington's son is saying on the phone, and then he gets put into extreme danger. It would make more sense, although it would be less dramatically it's implausible.
Can I ask you some film tips? For some film recommendations.
I'm just like saying that as soon as Adam Driver starts going undercover, he should be on the phone as well.
Sure.
Because then he would know all of the lies that he's telling.
Well, yeah.
You watch that film for the first time and then you go, this film's good. And then it gets to the point where you go, but it doesn't make sense that they're doing it this way. It falls apart. Anyway, sorry. You can ask me.
Well, when do you want to do my song and then talk about my fandom stuff?
We can do, mate, this is our format. Just calm down. Right? Take your foot off the fucking accelerator. But we're not working for XFM, XXFM.
Because I want to ask you for some film recommendations, because I think you guys will know a lot.
Should we do it after your song?
Okay.
This is a bone of contention here. You know this will wind me up.
Yeah, you know, but I came in here intentionally I'm not trying to wind you up. So me and Nick have an ongoing disagreement about Frank Zappa. I'm a big fan. And I think, Nick, you suffer from people going, you don't like Frank Zappa? You must like Frank Zappa. You like Alice Cooper. Haven't you listened to this? And that must be quite annoying.
Well, the thing is that you're a massive Frank Zappa fan. I'm a massive Alice Cooper fan. And Alice Cooper kind of has always gone on the record as owing his entire career to Frank Zappa. And I just can't get over how annoying I find his voice.
Right. Well, luckily, the song I picked is an instrumental, because over half of his stuff is instrumental
anyway.
There's
only one thing I hate more than his voice.
And that's his chance.
That's his... But, no, do you know what, though? I've tried many times to get into Frank Zappa. I'm not like, fuck this cunt, and I never go back. I have tried over the years. And if anyone could give me, like, a gateway into Frank Zappa...
Yeah.
Then it
more
would
than
be
happy
you.
To.
But I'm not...
And what is the track, John?
The track's called What's New in Baltimore, and it's an instrumental from an album called Frank Zappa Meets the Mothers of Prevention, which he released after testifying to the Senate about censorship in music. So they wanted to ban a lot of music in the 80s, like Prince.
Yeah, Judas Priest.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff. And Frank Zappa was instrumental in stopping that.
No pun intended.
And so you know the parental advisory sticker?
Yeah.
That is... directly as a result of Frank Zappa's work in testifying. And there's some great footage of him in court, and lots of other people testified as well, because there was one of a very prominent American politician's wife set up a group of sort of outraged people.
It was like, what was it? It was like a Outraged Mothers group that went around saying you're not allowed to listen to heavy metal music, you're not allowed to, you know, Bill Hicks did that whole routine about Judas Priest fans killing themselves. Basically, there were loads of suicides that were connected to Judas Priest in the 80s. But not just Judas Priest, but it was a whole load of...
It was a bit like the video nasty sort of movement over
it's
here.
It's almost exactly the same as that. It was kind of like the America's equivalent of Mary Whitehouse.
Wasn't it also the fella from Twisted Sister? Was he the guy who...
Dee Snider basically went into court dressed up as Dee Snider from Twisted Sister, and everyone was just like, who's this Neanderthal? And he went in and he just basically just destroyed every single argument that they had. There's a really interesting documentary about it. Forget its name, but you can probably YouTube it. But Dee Snider tells that story in every interview that you'll ever see of him. So
the this album, Frank Zappa Meets the Mothers of Prevention, was sort of inspired by that process, and since there's been another album released, because there's been a lot of posthumous ones released by the Zappa estate with actual recordings from that. But this is an instrumental called What's New in Baltimore.
Mothers of Prevention is quite a funny... name, isn't it?
Because that's what they were.
They were a mother's group of prevention, but obviously his group was called
Mothers of Invention.
Brilliant.
Yeah. don't know. Hey, what's new in Baltimore? Better go back and find out. Hey, what's new in Baltimore? What's new in Baltimore? What's new in Baltimore?
Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
It was Tipper Gore,
yes.
Who, Al Gore's wife, who was in charge of getting everyone banned in the 80s.
So we need to point out that wasn't the version that I, A, requested and B, described. That's not a problem, still
that's
a great
fan
version.
Club. That's Fan Club.
That's a live version from, I think...
Welcome to FUBAR, mate.
You can't do that.
Some people call it slumming.
Well, mate...
I call it.
I would get fired for playing that on Radio X, so no, it was an absolute pleasure.
Why would you go? Oh, because it's not on the playlist.
Yeah, well, it's not on any playlist. but that was from a live album. I think that's from You Can't Do That on Stage Anymore, Volume 3, featuring the drums of Chad Wackerman.
Hang on, is this the one that... Is this the version, then?
Yes.
Right. Did you just put that on? Was it there all along? So you put two versions of What's New in Baltimore on?
I mean, I'm more than happy to compare.
Oh, yeah, that's what I mean. Did you just put it on?
Live and album versions of Frank Zappa songs. That would be my dream.
Maybe this is the radio show.
The time signature in this first half is really interesting.
I would say...
This is the stuff that puts me off him.
Really? I liked the first half, didn't like the second half.
Interesting. My friend Robin likes the first half, not the second half. I like both halves.
I really like that.
Do you know what it's like? It's like Goblin.
Yeah, it is.
And I really like Goblin.
But then the difficult thing is, and this is the thing that Frank Zappa fans that say that might annoy you, is you could play two consecutive songs of the same album and you'd be like, these haven't been made by the same person. It's so broad in terms of genres that's like Goblin. He's got other stuff that's like Varez. And it can be a bit... It's quite very hard to get into him unless you find an organic way to do it.
That's what people say about my work as well.
Yes.
So, but I would say... hard to get into. This is worth talking about. Hard to get into. Frank Zappa. I would say that as much as I liked that last version that we played, the first version that we played, not that we played the whole of the second version, is that... I liked it, but I liked it on the same level that I liked the soundtrack to Little Shop of Horrors.
Uh-huh.
And I wouldn't ever say it was my favourite music to listen to, although I love Suddenly Seymour, and I will sing along with it.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I would say Frank Zappa isn't up there with the people I actually listen to the most. I will, because it's...
Do you feel that you appreciate him more than you love him?
I would say I appreciate him more than I listen to him.
Do you like Frank Zappa more than Queen?
In what sense?
Queen makes songs that you can dance to, sing along to. They make you feel emotions.
Queen is party music.
Well, not always. They make some of the saddest music. The soundtrack for Highlander has got some of the saddest... Highlander, the Christoph Lambert movie about cutting off immortal people's heads.
The first essay I ever wrote in media studies was about Highlander.
It's got some of the most beautiful music ever.
Yeah.
Who Wants to Live Forever?
Astonishing.
A film made for Highlander, you can't not listen to it and think about Freddie Mercury.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's such a sad, especially retrospectively, but it's such a sad, beautiful song that. And I just think, you say that you're a massive fan of Queen. I say I'm a massive fan of Alice Cooper, but I can totally, absolutely, 100% understand how much you love Queen based on how much I love Alice Cooper.
Yeah.
I say I love Alice Cooper, you say you love Frank Zappa. I'm just like, what? No, not with you specifically, but anyone. The kid from Uncle was really getting in. Elliot was really getting into Frank Zappa when we were on set.
Oh, brilliant!
And I was just like, and so I used that as a way to sort of like talk to it. He was getting into like, he would come in every day and he'd be like, oh, you'd never guess what. I've just started listening to this band. It's a really old band that I've been listening to. I'd be, oh yeah, what band's that? He goes, Pulp. Found it in my dad's record collection. And you go, shoot myself in the.
Do you not like Pulp?
No, I love Pulp.
Oh, right.
But he's like, he's an 11-year-old boy coming
and saying,
I've just found my dad's old record collection, Pulp. And you're just like, what?
My music...
Shaka Demerson Pliers. And you're like, oh, bloody hell.
My music, my sort of music obsessions went from the ages of sort of 11 onwards, went Queen, Pulp, Lou Reed, Frank Zappa and Captain Beefheart as a double play.
Yeah.
Then sort of post-rock, Godspeed and Mogwai. Then the band got into sort of early sort of alt country.
What's the band?
Americana, like Up on Cripple Creek and The Last Waltz.
Right. Oh, that's that's how I know it, don't I? From
The
Last Waltz.
And then Bonnie Prince Billy and Nico Case, and that's sort of my spectrum.
The band seemed like a bit of a swerve in that.
Well, that's what led me into Americana, like Nico Case and Bonnie Prince Billy. Right. And I think the band album, The Band, is an absolute master. It's a flawless masterpiece.
Have you ever seen the documentary? What was it be? It'd be, what was Frank Zappa's record label called?
Bizarre.
And what's the other one? Straight.
Barking Pumpkin.
Didn't he have Straight?
Straight, yeah.
Straight and Bizarre. I think it's called Bizarre, the Frank Zappa story or something.
Oh, right.
Have you ever seen
no,
that?
No, I haven't, no.
I think I've got it on DVD somewhere. I'll lend it to you.
Great.
Or I'll give it to you. It's got, because it's got, I bought it because it had a large bit about Alice Cooper. But yeah. The Alice Cooper thing with Frank Zappa is quite funny. Funny, weird. Funny. Well, basically, he said, I'll produce your album. And they went in. Their first two albums that Frank Zappa produced are awful. There are some bits in it which sound like Beatles songs, where they kind of like. But basically, Alice Cooper didn't really become a band until they started working with. I've forgotten his name. That producer that they worked with. Bob. Whatever.
I'm always slightly suspicious when famous musicians have produced other famous musicians, because you wonder how much of a producer's role they actually take.
So basically what happened was Frank Zappa, the whole Alice Cooper audition thing was Frank Zappa saw Alice Cooper at a concert, and it was a packed out concert, and Alice Cooper came on, and it was Bob Ezrin. Fucking hell, Bob Ezrin. How could I forget that? Bob Ezrin basically was like the sixth member of Alice Cooper who... produced them to the, it was like the George Martin, where he produced them to the point that that's what they sound like. But Frank Zappa went to see Alice Cooper in the 60s at a gig, and it was full of hippies, and Alice Cooper came out and cleared the room. And Frank Zappa was just like, I don't get it, but anyone that can do that, I want to kind of get involved. So he said to them, he said, why don't you come in tomorrow at 7, give us a little audition, and then and I'll see about signing you. And so the next morning at 7 a.m. The Alice Cooper band turned up at Frank Zappa's house and set up, and they started playing, and Frank Zappa comes down with his coffee and he goes, what the fuck are you doing? And they're going, you said 7. He goes, 7 p.m. guys. And he signed them, and so they went into the recording studio. And they did they were like tuning up and running through some songs and testing stuff up, but like mainly kind of like going for levels and working stuff out, fixing up the drum kit. And they said, when are we going to record the album? And Frank Zappa said, oh, you just did. And then he released it.
Amazing.
And they were like, what? And so their first album is basically the mic test, right, in the recording studio. And Frank Zappa spent like 45 minutes on producing their album, released it. And it was basically this kind of...
That's an answer to your previous question.
The whole Bizarre... his Bizarre record label was some sort of like way of filtering a certain amount of his income, and it's really dodgy what he did. And then the second album is slightly better, I think.
It's interesting.
Pretty's for You and Easy Action, they're both pretty awful albums.
Lou Reed had kind of an odd beef with Frank Zappa, because he once said he was the least talented musician ever heard in his life, which of all the things you could say about Frank Zappa, you can't say he's not a talented musician. He's too talented a musician to sort of contain it. But the Velvet Underground and the Mothers had a very similar ethos, really, which is that hippie culture is fake and as commercial as anything else, because you're just being sold this idea that somehow you're counterculture. But yet they did residencies in the same like clubs in New York and just didn't get on. And then they asked Lou Reed to induct Frank Zappa into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame after he died, which was just a very odd decision, and his family were quite upset.
Did he do it?
Yeah, he did. And he apologised. He said, I said some things about him.
He's
I didn't
agree. Perfect person to do it.
Yeah, maybe.
Why would you get, like, the biggest fan of who's preaching to the converted, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But then you get Lou Reed, who didn't get on, and then it,
but I think for the
in
family,
that goes, ah, oh, do you know what?
But it was it's a big deal, and I think if you were put into, I don't know, if they chose someone you absolutely despised to hand you an award who'd gone on record as saying they didn't like you, I think...
Well, a lot of the times, the people that you absolutely despised are in your band. When Blondie got inducted, yeah, none of them were talking to each other.
Yeah.
When Ace Frehley got inducted along with...
But also only two of the... It was like the new band, wasn't it, that turned up for it?
Well, Debbie Harry kind of like hijacked the whole event and kind of was like, I'm Blondie. And they were like, yeah, but we're Blondie. And like, nah... And that's what happened with Kiss, where the original band members of Kiss came along, but so did the new band members, they came along. But with Alice Cooper, when they got inducted, the Alice Cooper group got inducted. And that's kind of a weird thing, because they haven't been the Alice Cooper group since 1975. Mm.
But don't you have to have been dead for a certain amount of time to get inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, or that outfit has to have not been making stuff for a certain amount of time?
Is that how it works?
Yeah, so like Coldplay couldn't go into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I don't think.
And Alice Cooper solo. But I'm glad that it was the Alice Cooper band. It was lovely because it meant that they did a load of gigs together. Mm. But basically, he fucked those boys over big time. Mm. But he was young. I never apologised.
So can I ask you a film question?
Yeah, of course.
My favourite genre of film is The Cozy Catastrophe, which is actually a genre of literature that was sort of coined in the 80s, I think. So like Day of the Triffids. So basically, and it's also my life fantasy, something terrible has happened, but you, within certain limits, are okay. So perfect example would be a Mega Man.
I was just about to say.
So, and I've Googled and gone through all the lists and watched most of them. So like, that's perfect. Charlton Heston. He's got the Mona Lisa on the wall of his house. He's got a 16th century cognac. All he has to do...
He's got the cinema to himself, and all he's watching is Woodstock, the movie.
And all
why would you watch Woodstock, the movie?
And all you have to do is not go out at night.
Yeah.
And that's my dream, the sort of fantasy of isolation, but also luxury within that.
I used to have that in my old flat. It was underground.
Yes.
And I never left.
So what films are there that I might not have heard of where there's been some... I mean, ideally apocalyptic or virus or nuclear winter, where someone is left with some level of I just love those survival films anyway.
Just thinking that if it was set in the 80s, you could do a film where it's a guy who basically never liked leaving his house, just played on his computer all the time, and it's the same plot as that Charlton Heston movie, but no one's dead. And it's called Amiga Man.
Oh,
very
nice.
And it's just him on his computer. So what would be my version of that? Oh, this is a...
It is tough.
It's a tough...
I wish I'd had a primer.
Literally, my example of it would have been...
The Amiga Man.
Yeah, Amiga Man. And now it's going to have to be...
But like even
I Am Legend.
Yeah, which I just like, because I like any film like that. But even even The Road, when they go into that bunker, that's one of my favourite
bits. When they're all right
bits.
For a bit.
Yeah, and they've just got loads of food.
This isn't answering your question, but have you ever seen The Postman?
No, because... And that's one I'm sort of holding off because the reviews are just so terrible. But is it all right?
No, I've seen bits of The Postman, and I'm a big Kevin Costner apologist, I guess, now, because apparently no one's allowed to like Kevin Costner. All of his good films are shit films. I love Dance with Wolves, and I saw Robin Hood this week. Anyway, The Postman is a weird film because it starts off and you think, I know where this film's going, and then it goes absolutely fucking mental. It goes into sort of like... Bill Patton doing Shakespeare recreations. It's just the most self-indulgent piece of shit.
Have you seen... there's a film with Saoirse Ronan called City of Ember.
It's also got Bill Murray
in it, which got a cast and a sort of an aesthetic that you think this should have been done quite well. It's sort of slightly Roald Dahl-ish in a vision of the future in this sort of... sort of cordoned off city where Bill Murray is a corrupt mayor. And also, have you seen Snowpiercer?
No.
So that's where, like, the whole
is
world
is... Chris Evans, not that one,
I can't remember. But it's got... the whole world is frozen, apart from
a train
that's going round
yeah,
the world.
Chris Evans, yeah.
We've got to do this.
I guess it would be maybe Escape from New York or Escape from LA.
Okay.
And my fantasy would be being Snake Plissken.
So those two are good ones where people have got basically lots
thugs.
Of booze, but they can't go outside. That's what I want my life to
the
be.
The thing?
Yeah. Do you know what my all-time fantasy would be?
Yeah.
Would be in something like 28 Days Later and doing a supermarket sweep.
Yes, trapped yes. in a pub. That's my fantasy. That's what
but,
I think about.
But it would be. It wouldn't be a supermarket sweep. It would be mid-90s to 2000s, and it would be HMV.
We got to do this quiz.
Yeah, we're doing the quiz.
So this is better or worse, John, and I give you a series of names, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my own opinion.
Without knowing the next person?
Just, I'll tell you the next person.
Okay.
Starting off with... Julie Walters.
Yeah.
Chris Pratt, better or worse than Julie Walters, based on my opinion?
Don't really know who Chris Pratt is, so I'm going worse.
He is worse. Nicole Kidman, better or worse than Chris Pratt?
Better.
Better, she is. Daniel Craig, better or worse?
Worse.
Worse, yeah. Diana Ross, better or worse than Daniel
better,
Craig?
Better.
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 Although, was best friends with Michael Jackson.
Jonah Hill, better or worse than Diana Ross?
I think probably...
Worse?
Better now, worse then.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think he's worse in general, in the whole sphere.
Yeah.
William Shatner, better or worse than Jonah Hill?
As a performer or an actor or a person?
As a person.
Worse.
Better.
Better, I reckon.
He's an awful man.
Simon Pegg, better or worse than William Shatner?
Worse.
I find his comic asides in Star Trek very grating, and also in Mission Impossible.
I like him. He could be a high card.
Worse. He's worse than William
also,
Shatner.
Also, The World's End is the greatest crime. You know, I was talking about bad artistic decisions with Tubular Bells for Two. When that film goes from being the best film I've ever seen about pub nostalgia into a crappy little comic book thing,
gonna
I was
have to
absolutely
contain
heartbroken.
My guess now and rattle through it, John.
Okay, sure.
Okay, he's worse. Michael Caine, better or worse than
better.
Simon Pegg? Better. Emily Blunt, better or worse than Michael Caine?
Michael Caine, better or worse than Simon Pegg?
Yeah,
better.
Emily Blunt, better.
I'm going to say worse.
Okay.
Michael Caine, I love Emily Blunt.
Sure.
I love her. Wolfman.
That's it. What's this? Seven.
I'm sorry, I talked for quite
seven.
A lot of that.
No, not a problem.
I could have got a higher score if I hadn't talked.
No, you got a seven. You got a seven. But so you join with seven: Hayley Campbell, Brett Goldstein, Tom Goodman, Hill, Charlie Hickson, Matthew Holness, Jim Hoskin, Laura Lex, Esther Smith,
stake,
Ian Smith,
I would
Josh Whitcomb, Charlie Rockner with seven.
And I would have
although
won.
You are not as good as John Niven, Sean Harris with ten,
oh
Daniel
God,
Cook, Daniel Lawrence,
now.
Taylor, Michael Legg, Solomon Gray with nine, Clodagh Blakely, Jordan Brooks, Suze Kempner, Paul F. Taylor, Rebecca Shaw, Mark Smith, Carl Theobald with eight. But you are better than Drunk Women Solving Crimes with six, Colin Holt, Andy
quiz.
Kindler, Merrick Larwood, Lucy Porter, Richard Sandling, Mark Simmons, David Trent with six, Yasmin Akram, Rob Deering with five, Jack Barry, Bunny Galore, Taylor Glenn and Katie Wilkins with
thank
three
you very much for having
with
me.
Four and
thank
Sam
you.
Ashurst with three. So thank you very much for listening, and now we are leaving the studio. Okay, we'll play that one.
You've been listening to a FUBAR Radio podcast. For more information, go to FUBARradio.com.